All the residents over 60 were invited to the village school so that they could follow the occasion live on colour television, followed by a buffet lunch with a replica of the wedding cake. There was a tea party for local children, a fireworks display, and a barbecue of suckling pig. Across the country, schools had devoted hours to telling their pupils about the significance of the day, while retailers had slashed their prices to induce viewers to invest in new televisions so that they could appreciate the spectacle in glorious colour. And when the BBC collated its viewing figures afterwards, it emerged that a staggering 28 million people had tuned in to watch the wedding live, the third biggest television audience of the decade, after the Apollo 13 splashdown and the FA Cup final replay between Chelsea and Leeds 3 years before. Indeed, thanks to the wonders of technology, it was not merely a national event, but an international one. In the Republic of Ireland, bitterness at recent events in Belfast and Londonderry did not stop so many people tuning in that Dublin's electricity board struggled to cope with the demand. In France, an estimated 10 million people gathered around their televisions. In West Germany, many British servicemen were given time off to watch the wedding, and army wives held parties around their glowing sets. And in the United States and Canada, where live coverage began at 5 in the morning on the East Coast, the wedding dominated the breakfast bulletins. So many Americans were glued to their televisions, reports said later, that they ended up being late for work. Yet, although American viewers loved the royal wedding for its patina of tradition, the very fact of the television coverage reflected the extraordinary changes that had overtaken British life since London's last major royal occasion. In 1953, when the coronation had been the first such event shown live on television, most people had not owned a set. Even though ownership doubled to 3 million in the run-up to the big day, the vast majority of Britons had watched the ceremony with friends, family and neighbours gathered in awe around a popping, crackling black-and-white box. By 1973, however, almost every family in the country had a set of their own. Watching television, once a relative luxury, was now by far the most popular form of entertainment in the country, so deeply embedded in national cultural life that the Dean of Westminster agreed to share his viewing recommendations for the week with the readers of the Radio Times. He would be watching Dad's Army the night before the wedding, he admitted, but not Match of the Day, which was on a bit late. And although some people held parties or invited relatives for lunch, most watched in the privacy of their own homes. The collective solidarity exemplified by the coronation street parties was now an increasingly distant memory. By 1973, even working-class families were used to spending their evenings, weekends and holidays on their own, basking in the benefits of the affluent society. If a Londoner from the cheering coronation crowds had been catapulted forward 20 years to the wedding of the Queen's daughter, what would he have made of Britain in 1973? No doubt he would have been amused by the new fashions, the jeans and sweaters that many spectators wore that cool November morning, the flares and high heels, the Parker anoraks and flowing maxi dresses, the sheepskin coats and corduroy jackets, the miniskirts left over from the late 1960s, the long sideburns and shaggy beards, the long-haired men and the women in trousers. But he would surely have been more struck by the general air of prosperity and comfort, by the fact that so many people had cars of their own, by the central heating, the indoor toilets, the gleaming new kitchens and bathrooms, by the appliances, telephones, fridges, washing machines, that families now took for granted. Casting his eyes across the skyline, he would have been startled by the slim cylindrical intrusion of the post office tower, that supreme symbol of the technological modernity of the 1960s. But he would have been even more stunned by the vast concrete monoliths along the horizon, the glowering council tower blocks and faceless office buildings that had utterly transformed the urban landscape. And if, as the royal carriages rolled past, he had broken away from the crowds and turned towards the West End, he would surely have rubbed his eyes in wonder at the high street fashion stores overflowing with new designs, the bookshops groaning under their weight.